On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss recent changes to the State Operations Manual Appendix Z related to emergency preparedness, nurse manager recruitment and training, new tools for infection control coordinators, changes that might be needed to your QI program stemming from the changes to the Medicare quality reporting requirements, and we take a close look at case costing.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a biweekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC and regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource the regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 47 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. We're recording from our temporary studio on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and he is the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs and the recently released Finance and Accounting for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics, and he is the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So as I mentioned, we're in Hilton Head Island for this week. We are getting a little bit of work done.
We are, yeah. It's working on a shorter schedule, but yeah. I guess the big difference here, instead of looking out the window at, 10 feet of snow, we're looking out at an ocean. So.
Yes.
I think we're doing all right. Nobody seems to be feeling sorry for us now.
No, but I think it's good for us because, as you can tell, we're still kind of getting over cold. So, again, I apologize for if our voices are a little harsh.
I don't even sound like myself now. Yeah. This coughing, but
we're resting and recuperating.
You're going to have to be cutting off a lot of coughs out of this.
I know. But no dogs walking around.
That's right, right.
So it's kind of a toss-up because they're at home with
and the unfortunately, rest you can't hear the ocean in the background here because yeah. I have these sensitive mics. But
we just got back from a walk on the beach, yeah. And it's probably a little below 60. So it's cool, but it just feels wonderful, though.
It's
and it's so pretty out there.
If you haven't been to Hilton Head Island, I just highly recommend it. It's one of our favorite vacation spots. Yeah. And we come down here quite a bit.
And I was floating around in the heated pool today. John didn't quite dare get in there.
No.
It was wonderful until I had to get out 60 yeah, degrees and head for the room.
It ran awful fast.
I did. I don't usually move that quick.
So go from a very warm place to a very cold place.
Yep.
Our client up in Plattsburgh, New York, upstate New York, passed their deemed status survey yeah. with flying colors. We are so proud of them. They did a fantastic job of being prepared and really an incredible survey. And thank you for everybody that worked on getting them ready for it. Mm-hmm. And they are a new proud member of the Certified Ambulatory Surgery Centers.
Yep, they did great.
Under Medicare. So.
So ASCA has a new infection prevention community on their ASCA Connect. Now, this is for members only, but it's an online community, kind of a forum where members can network and talk to other people in infection prevention. So it's a great resource if you are an ASCA member or if you become an ASCA member.
I think it's the only resource out there that really focuses only on issues in the ASC industry. I think there's a lot of opportunities to talk questions in outpatient, but not necessarily in an ASC environment.
Yeah.
And certainly a lot of opportunities for infection control nurses in the hospital environment.
Yeah.
And then also, just as we were recording, we found out that CMS has revised the interpretive guidelines for emergency preparedness, which is Appendix Z. More specifically, it's Appendix Z to the State Operations Manual, or the SOM. So as we all know, the State Operations Manual, Appendix Z, is the manual that surveyors use to assess emergency preparedness within our organizations. So CMS is adding in the new revision, emerging infectious diseases, to the current definition of the all-hazards approach. We'll talk about the all-hazards approach just to remind people what we mean. After review, CMS determined it was critical for facilities to include planning for infectious diseases within their emergency preparedness program in light of events such as Ebola and Zika. And they believe that the facility should consider preparedness and infection prevention within their all-hazards approach, which covers both natural and man-made disasters. So what they're talking about here is, in your hazard vulnerability analysis, or your HVA that you do every year, you need to include a section in infection control. Now, Sue, what's interesting about this is that we also have an infection control risk assessment that we do every year. And, you know, we encourage our centers to consider things such as infectious diseases in that section. So basically what I think this is saying is that we need to consider infectious diseases in both planning at the very high level, at the HVA level, and also at the center level, which is really the infection control risk assessment that we prepare. So two of the risk assessments have to be done every year, both focusing now, making sure that we focus a little bit on the infectious diseases. Additionally, since the release of the interpretive guidelines for emergency preparedness in 2017, there has been a request from providers for clarifications related to mobile and portable generators. So this gets a little confusing, but CMS has basically said, as I can read it here, that you can use emergency standby power systems if they are the most appropriate energy source for electrical systems based on the review of the individual's all-hazard risk assessment, and as required by existing regulations or state requirements. So what they're saying is that you can use a system temporarily if you have to, in order to maintain like temperature and humidity within the center, or to you know, keep the emergency systems up and running.
Okay.
But of course, you can't do any procedures while you're running. You can't do any procedures when you're running under an emergency generator, and you certainly can't do it when you're running under this alternative power source.
So it can't be your full plan. You can't just say, well, I'm just going to have a portable generator.
I think what they're really trying to say, it is confusing. There's not a lot out there on this. But I think what we're trying to say is that when you have a disaster such as like Hurricane Sandy, which affected, you know, many of our centers, you're looking at your center, you're trying to mitigate whatever disaster has occurred. And sometimes you just, you know, maybe your generator has failed, or maybe your generator is not powering a part of the center.
Kind of an extra tool that you can pull these things
in. And they're saying that, okay, you can use that tool temporarily and not have to do all of the other things that you have to do with a regular portable regular generator here. And then as soon as the disaster is over, you know, of course it goes away. But when you do this, you document it thoroughly. You document the fact that you've, you know, done a risk assessment, that you're using a safe alternative, and that, you know, there's a specific reason that you're doing this. So I think this is a very logical approach. I think as best I can tell, certainly we'll get more information as time goes on. And of course, it is obvious that the provisions under the emergency preparedness themselves do not take away any of the existing requirements under life safety code. So that doesn't mitigate what's happening. I thought we probably should mention the all hazards approach again here, because I think while we've talked about another podcast here, it's always good to talk about it, you know, periodically. So I thought we would kind of discuss the all-hazards approach again, since we've talked about it in previous episodes, but not everybody listens to every episode. So the all-hazards approach is an integrated approach to emergency preparedness planning that focuses on capabilities and capacities that are critical to preparedness for a full spectrum of emergencies or disasters. In other words, you have to take a very broad look at all of the things that can happen to an organization. But you have to focus on what this specific organization in this specific location could encounter. So, for example, in the middle of America, you are not going to be talking about hurricanes. Likewise, well, I guess tornadoes seem to be popping up everywhere, but tornadoes are not certainly in every part of the country here. Perhaps Alaska, I don't think you're going to be talking about that. And avalanches, you're not going to be talking about in Hawaii, at least not yet. Key aspects of an all-hazard approach to risk assessment include developing plans that are flexible and scalable enough to adapt to a wide variety of disasters, focusing on the continuity of essential services that must remain consistent regardless of the disaster, and assessing the risk most likely to affect an individual, facility, and community, like I just said. So you should be doing a hazard vulnerability analysis on an annual basis using the all-hazards approach, updating it. Now, very rarely do we find things that are different that, have changed the scope of the types of disasters that you'll have. So it's just a matter of updating the vulnerability analysis based upon last year's information, like what disaster drills you did, what disasters might have actually occurred, what your preparedness has been, it's been additional training and things like that.
Yeah. And I just wanted to mention, as we were going through some policies this past couple of weeks, we noticed that, or we were reminded that with the CMS reporting changes, you want to update your policies on those to make sure that don't have it mentioned that you're going to report them if they are not reportable.
Right. I think you're referring to the Medicare quality reporting requirements, which stripped away a lot of the quality reporting requirements. And I think as you were reviewing a couple of policy manuals, we noticed that the policy manuals are very specific about including all of those items. And we hadn't even caught that we had been that specific in there. So you might want to look at your policy manuals if you've decided not to track that information anymore.
Yeah, because you still can. And that's just a good overall thing to just check on your policies every so often, and as well as maybe try not to be too specific in a lot of those.
Right, right. Things. You spend most of your life reading policies, so you certainly know the problems. So let's discuss a few things that have been going on in the past couple of weeks, kind of experiences we've had. The first one, Sue, is a grievance versus a complaint. You started this.
Yeah, I had some questions about that. Just how do you exactly differentiate those things?
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely know a grievance is something where a patient has written something to you and said, I have a grave concern about this, this particular aspect of your operation. I want you to take care of it and get back to me. I mean, that's an obvious grievance.
Yeah.
But basically, a grievance is something that you receive either in writing or in person, that the person is identifiable, so it can't be anonymous, and that there is some indication from the person that they want you to take an action. It's not like, oh, FYI, I really didn't like the chairs in the waiting area. They want you to do something about it, and you have to respond in some way, such as in writing. Where it gets a little confusing is when we get what we call complaints, like somebody writes in their satisfaction survey that they didn't like the furniture in the waiting area. That then it gets down to, well, certainly if it's anonymous, it's certainly not a grievance because you can't do anything. And then it becomes a judgment call. So, for example, that example I just gave, if somebody complains about the furniture in the waiting area and gives you their name, but doesn't say in there that you need to do something about it, I would not consider that a grievance.
Yeah.
It gets a little sticky if they do say, I am so angry with the, quality of your waiting room, you need to do something about this.
Yeah.
Well, then it becomes a grievance, even though it's kind of an odd
one. It's a silly grievance, but it is a grievance.
And by the way, I've had that happen. So, I can speak from firsthand experience that you do get some weird grievances out there. But it's easy to talk about it in theory like we are right now. But I think, when you sit down and look at them and always take the high road. I mean, there's any bit of doubt and you know who the person was that wrote the complaint, treat it as a grievance if you want to, for no other reason, it's good public relations. So.
And you had mentioned that you don't have to get specific about the actions that you took. You don't have to discuss what the disciplinary action was or anything.
Correct.
Just let them know that you've taken it seriously, you've addressed the problem,
right,
and, try to kind of smooth things over and address it in whatever way you
that's right
you need to do.
Yeah, you don't need to say, well, that person was fired and et cetera.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you, one of the biggest challenges we're having right now is nurse administrator recruitment. And it's just to the point right now where there really are not a lot of nurse administrators out there, experienced nurse administrators. Recently we were looking at a resume. This individual is coming with 30 years of experience as a charge nurse in a hospital, never been in an ambulatory surgery center, never really been even in the outpatient section of the surgery center or of the hospital. And they're coming and looking for a job here. Now, the owner thinks that this might be a good candidate. I'm, skeptical about it, obviously, because my experience is that people that have spent that much time working in the hospital, especially if they've heard rumors that, oh my goodness, it's, you know, better hours over at the surgery center. It's going to be, you know, it's not going to be as difficult. Well, mm-hmm. we all know that that is not the truth at all, that ambulatory surgery centers are a much more high pressure environment than the hospitals mm-hmm. are. Their hours might be better, but there's, you know, a real push for rapid turnover. You often don't have the specialization that you do in the hospitals. You might have to do, you know, more different types of procedures, mm-hmm. whereas in a hospital, you might have a little bit more specialization or nurses that work with specific doctors all mm-hmm. the time, and you certainly don't see that on a regular basis. So it is a real challenge moving somebody into nurse administration. There are not a lot of them out there. And, you know, frankly, one of the problems that we have in some of our centers is people are just not willing to relocate to, you know, many of the locations mm-hmm. that our centers are located. Yeah. You know, that could be the big city or it could be out in, you know, rural Texas. Mm-hmm. It's very, you know, challenging in many cases for them to find that. And then smaller centers really have a difficult time even paying for these nurse managers. So that's another part of it is that, you know, even if they could find somebody, they couldn't afford that price.
Yeah. And the training in the smaller centers has to be difficult because they may be the only one that's doing their job. If the person before them left,
right,
then other people in the center might not even have a real good handle on what it is they're doing. Was. And so how do you get that training?
Yeah, it is. And that there's often long gaps between, you know, nurse managers when you lose them. So mm-hmm. so here's an important thing for everybody listening. Treat your nurse managers very well so mm-hmm. that they stay. But when they go, be prepared for some problems. And I think, you know, one of our challenges as ambulatory healthcare strategies, as a consulting organization working in regulatory compliance, is that we often are the people that have to do the training of these mm-hmm. individuals. What we're finding, though, is it's getting to the point where really companies like ours, like AHS, are spending more time really kind of being the outsourced quality improvement program. Mm-hmm. You know, we're able to fill in that gap. And whereas in the beginning, it used to be that, well, we were a temporary solution mm-hmm. until the nurse manager could get up to speed. Now we're finding that, well, you know, it's more cost effective mm-hmm. actually for companies such as ours or, you know, certainly our competitors out there to handle the quality improvement, documentation and the follow-up and, you know, working on the meetings.
And then you have some type of consistency with all of the turnover, whether it's a company like ours or the owner or the doctors, people get involved. You just can't leave it in one person's hands. And then when they leave, you're stuck and you have no idea what's going on. We've seen that happen before.
It is. And I just thought we should bring this up simply because it is becoming a major problem. And mm-hmm. we have a hard enough time recruiting nurses, but the nurse administrators, managers are it's getting even difficult. So, mm-hmm. you know, the secrets of dealing with nurse management turnover is certainly making sure you have good mentoring of the new mm-hmm. person coming in. Hopefully, you know, we have this one situation where, you know, we have our outgoing nurse manager, you know, is literally spending a month with this person, and that person will be well prepared for their mm-hmm. their position. So we're very, very happy to have that. Look very carefully at the job responsibilities and see if there's some things that you can split up. So maybe that nurse manager doesn't need to be the infection control coordinator, mm-hmm. doesn't need to be doing employee health, doesn't need to be doing all the nursing chart audits. Anything that you can split up among the other nurses will make their jobs a little bit more rewarding, perhaps, as well as kind of spread the joy, shall we say, all the documentation that's required.
Yeah, just appreciate what a tough job it can be and show that you value that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we're running into some situations right now where the owners really don't appreciate the job of the nurse manager, don't mm-hmm. understand that, you know, now we're seeing, well, can you push off some of the work there to the administrator? Because all they're doing is paperwork. Well, it's not all paperwork. Nursing administration is a very highly skilled job, and mm-hmm. Police has some respect for it. So, well, let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about case costing.
So, John, you've had a lot of questions lately about case costing, and as we were talking about it, I realized I've been hearing a lot about it, but I don't really have a handle on what it's for, how you do it. So,
you're sleeping during your case costing classes in nursing school.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think you missed them, no. Especially since you were an A student. You didn't miss anything. But yeah, certainly case costing is getting a lot of attention again. And, anybody that has heard me speak about it knows that I have very strong opinions about case costing. And mm-hmm. I guess there's been some confusion lately. Some recent webinars have kind of led people in an interesting direction on case costing. So I thought I would spend some time talking about the ways to do it right. And I think what happens is sometimes these speakers, might not have the experience in the ambulatory surgery industry or don't understand their unique attributes here. If you come from an accounting background, case costing is one thing. But when you're in the ASC industry, it's very different.
Okay.
So I really thought, it's about time that we talk about it here. And by the way, our audiences have been telling us that we need to put more financial content in.
Yep.
So I don't want to make
them.
So this is the beginning of it. We'll be talking about budgeting soon. Thank you for the people that have brought that up. That's another hot topic, I know. So let's start by tackling the question of why do we do case costing in the first place? Because before you set out doing case costing, there better be a darn good reason that you're doing it. So in the past, there was this argument, like 30 years ago when I started in the industry, everybody said, we got to do case costing so that you can go to the insurance company and show them why you need to be reimbursed so much for a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very flawed argument.
I have a feeling they don't care.
Right, exactly. And that's I get a lot of laughs when I speak about this in public, in conferences. It's like, does the car dealer convince you to pay more for a car when they provide a summary of all the costs that go into making a car? No. I mean, I've been with you when you've been car shopping. It's pretty much, you're going to laugh at them. And you want a good deal.
Yeah.
As do the insurance companies. If they can come back and show that they're paying less than what it costs to do the procedure, they're actually going to say, we're getting a good deal here. They really don't care. And of course, it's a very competitive environment. Maybe they cared 30 years ago, but today they don't, because now there's competition. And so if you're going into case costing to prove to an insurance company that this is the rate you should be getting, stop it right now. It's going to be a waste of your time. The best uses of case costing are, looking into business processes. So, for example, determining whether you should continue doing procedures is a very valuable reason to do case costing. Identifying opportunities to influence surgeons to find less expensive options for supplies. This happened to me a number of years ago when we were doing retina procedures in one of my centers, is that we found that the case costing for Dr. A, B, and C could vary by $200 to $300.
Oh, wow.
And, now I don't know that we were terribly successful in convincing the lower cost doctors to convince the higher cost doctors to bring the cost down, but it was certainly good information to identify where we had some opportunities for improvement there. And then when you get to the point where you're looking to add a new service and you have multiple options, but you can only choose one of them. Let's say that you've decided that you can either add GI or ophthalmology. You might want to do case costing to figure out which of those two options is going to bring you more money, which is going to be the most profitable for you, because you can only choose one. That's why, as we get a little bit more into this in a few minutes, you'll see, where my approach to this is much more, business-oriented here. So the best way to do case costing in ASCs is to approach it with what we would call a gross margin approach. So in order to do a gross margin approach to case costing, this is what you need. Information about the cost of supplies for the procedure, the direct labor for the procedure, and the direct equipment for the procedure. So that's a relatively small list compared to probably some of the lists you've seen from people that have suggested that you should do case costing. And then also get revenue information so that you can actually calculate the gross margin. Now remember, it's going to be different for each payer. So you might want to use an average. You might want to create, cost profiles for each of the different individual insurance companies, or you can calculate it as a percentage of your net revenue. So let's start by talking about the supplies for a procedure. So when we're calculating the supplies cost for a procedure, it's best to work directly with the nursing staff to identify all the supplies and the implants that are used in this. And they're, very adept, I'm sure. Give them a spreadsheet, give them a sheet of paper, whatever you need to do in order to be able to figure out everything that goes into that procedure.
Mm-hmm.
If this is a new procedure and your nurses don't have any experience in it, you can work with the vendor or with the doctor to figure out all of those things that go into it. You might want to separate out the implant costs. Because sometimes when you include the implant cost, it really kind of, makes it very difficult to see how much of it is implant versus the other supplies cost. The second thing is the direct equipment for the procedure. This is anything that you have to buy that's specific to this type of procedure that can't be used in anything else. Mm-hmm. So example would be ophthalmology. A phacoemulsifier can only be used on cataract procedures. Mm-hmm. So that would be specific to this procedure. But you might have a microscope that you can use both on ENT procedures and with the eye procedures, in which case that, you know, you're going to have to allocate the cost between those two different types of procedures.
And how do you know how to divide that up if you're doing, by how many procedures you're doing and how long it will last?
Right. So what you want to do on in this situation is figure out, let's say that a phacoemulsifier, let's just use a number of $100,000. Let's say you think it's going to last 5 years. And during that time, you can do, you know, 100,000 procedures. Well, that would be a dollar per procedure for that. Okay. So you try to figure out a cost per procedure for that equipment based upon its expected life.
Okay. And the vendors probably can help you out.
Well, yes. Of course, the vendors will.
Take it with a grain of salt, but they'll get you in the right ballpark.
And again, you know, consult with people that are familiar with this. They'll be able to help you with that. So that gets us to direct labor for the procedure, because this is often the toughest part. Now, this is where I think a lot of speakers or people that are talking about doing case costing get it wrong. So often people unfamiliar with the ASC industry will suggest calculating on a per-minute basis. But this ignores the true cost of providing the services. So, for example, they'll say, well, let's calculate it based upon the number of minutes that the procedure is being done and then how many minutes is going to go into that. Well, if you do that, you're not going to account for everything that's going on. So there are other people that are involved in the procedure, and you know, the employees in the room are the obvious ones, but you also got people that are doing sterilization. You got the preoperative nurse who makes the calls to the patients. You have the postoperative nurse who follows up afterwards. You have the purchasing clerks who purchased all the supplies that went into it. It can get very confusing if you try to figure those costs out. It also forgets the other costs associated with the employee's hours. For example, every employee, full-time employee at least, is going to have vacation and PTO. You're going to have holiday pay. You're going to have sick time. You're going to have training time. And you're going to have, unfortunately, non-productive time or time that's not dedicated to actually doing the procedure. Mm-hmm. All of those costs have to be factored into the direct costs associated with the procedure. So luckily, there is an easier way to do this, and that's just to calculate an average clinical hours per case, which anybody that's heard me speak knows that this is one of my favorite calculations in the entire world. So in calculating clinical hours per case, what you do is you look at the total paid hours. Remember, paid hours for all of the clinical staff that are involved in the procedure. This would be the circulating nurses, the pre-op nurses, the post-op nurses, the nurses that make the pre-op phone calls, the nurses that make the post-op phone calls, the sterilization people, the individuals that do the technicians, the people that are involved in the turnover. All of those are going to be direct costs. There's costs that are associated directly with doing the procedure. So you take the total paid hours for all of those individuals and you divide it by the number of cases for that same time frame. You know, so if you have 12,000 clinical hours for a period of time in 1,000 cases, that would be 12 clinical hours per case. Very simple calculation. You can do it almost in your head, and you don't have to gather in a lot of information. Now, what you're going to find is that these numbers vary dramatically depending upon the type of cases that you're doing. For example, GI procedures are going to be somewhere around 5 clinical hours per case. Pain procedures could be even less, between 4 and 5. You're going to find orthopedic cases can be anywhere between 10 and 14. General cases can be anywhere between 10 and 12. So what you want to do is figure out what your clinical hours per case are in your operation and use that number when you're calculating the cost per case for your operation. And then also in addition to that, you add a factor for employee benefits. So you're going to want to take the hours and multiply it by your average labor cost to come up with the total costs for labor for the procedure, and then add a factor for the employee benefits based upon your employee benefit ratio. Let's say that your benefits ratio, which would be the total benefits divided by your total labor costs, is 23%. Then you want to up your labor costs by another 23%. And all of these items add up to your total direct cost per case. Now, if you're interested in a spreadsheet, send me an email at info@ASCpodcast.com, and I'd be glad to send you some information about this because I know we've talked through this a lot. Now, what do we do once we have this data? We use the cost data to compare doctors against other doctors. So this could be very helpful in comparing, you know, one doctor against another. You can use it to improve profitability. You want to be able to, you know, find supplies maybe that you don't need in the procedure, or maybe there's cheaper supplies that you can use. Maybe you can find a less time intensive. Maybe you can find a way to decrease the number of clinical hours per case. And by looking at these hours, if you're measuring them, you can, you know, make it a target to bring those numbers down. And then you can also calculate the gross margin. So this is where this becomes particularly helpful. If you look at the total revenue for the procedure and subtract out that cost per case, those direct costs per case, you'll come up with what we call gross margin, which is simply the difference between the revenue per the procedure and the direct cost for the procedure. And that was what we would call gross margin. So that number, that dollar amount that you've come up with, we call it a gross margin because this is a gross amount of money that's available to pay your overhead costs. Notice that we didn't talk about overhead at all. And I've noticed that some of the speakers recently have, you know, these whole sections in their presentations about how do you calculate overhead. Well, you don't. Because remember, overhead in a cost per case scenario varies dramatically depending upon the number of cases that you're doing. And if you're working less than full capacity, then it's unfairly going to push that overhead number higher and give you a misleading number. So the nice thing about a gross margin approach is, first of all, it helps you to determine whether you even need to do those procedures in the first place. Mm-hmm. If your gross margin is negative, that means that you're not even bringing in enough revenue to cover your direct costs. Mm-hmm. In other words, you would actually save money by no longer doing those procedures. Mm-hmm. Anytime that you're doing a procedure where your gross margin is negative, it's time to stop doing those procedures. Yeah. The second thing is, over the years, I've had doctors who have made really poor decisions based upon information that I unfortunately gave to them without being able to convince them of the total package. This is why I don't put overhead costs into the calculation anymore. Mm-hmm. A number of years ago, this doctor, you know, asked me to calculate the cost per case for GI procedures. And I showed the gross margin, just like we talked about here. And then I put an overhead cost in based upon mm-hmm. their current overhead cost. Now, they were making some money, so their number was pretty good. Well, he went out and looked at this number and said, our cost per case is almost exactly equal to our revenue per case. And he decided to do away with the entire GI practice, which was 50% of his volume, mm-hmm. which meant that he would have to really get rid of 50% of his overhead also. Yeah. Yeah. So he actually ended up losing money as a result of that decision. No matter what I told him after I had shown him those numbers, he was utterly convinced that by getting rid of these mm-hmm. Those cases, he was going to start making money.
Yeah, but the overhead's not changing.
The overhead's not changing at all. And then I'll tell you the other thing that happened with this case is that he couldn't get rid of all the direct employees. So, mm-hmm. you know, he would have had to have gotten rid of all those nurses yeah. that were serving that practice, and he did not do that, which made his situation even worse. So you can really make some very poor decisions here if you're not careful. Now, I'm trying to describe, of course, case costing in a podcast, which is a very difficult scenario. So if you are interested in a spreadsheet, I can send me an email at info@ascpodcast.com. I'd be glad to talk about it a little bit more with you. So one last thought about overhead costs is one thing that's important is that as long as your gross margin is positive, as long as you're making money on cases, your revenue is higher than your direct costs, you should always take on new cases until you reach the point at which you no longer have any capacity. Mm-hmm. At that point, then you start making decisions about whether you choose one option over another. And that's, again, a very confusing thing for inexperienced ASC leaders or accountants that don't understand the industry is that frequently we are not anywhere near capacity. Mm-hmm. So we should be selecting any option that gives us more net margin.
When I saw that in your notes, that really struck me because I could see it being like, well, we're not making that much, but if you're not at full capacity, anything's better than nothing. And
that's right.
You know, well, you're going
to
get there.
There's also this argument. We've got centers that, you know, are not able to keep their nurses at full time.
Mm-hmm.
And
then you lose the nurses.
That's right. I mean, actually, in these cases, it's actually worthwhile. We have, you know, they take on cases that are not mm-hmm. making any money at all, but it is helping to cover their overhead.
Yeah.
And they can keep those nurses that they would mm-hmm. lose otherwise. So yeah. if they didn't have those procedures, even though they're not making a stitch of money on them,
yeah.
if you include the direct costs even, in other mm-hmm. words, their revenue and their direct costs are equal. Yeah. So there's no contribution margin at all.
Okay. And then I kind of got stuck on this when you said it. But
it's no problem.
How do you figure out clinical hours per case?
Yeah. So I guess I went over that a little bit too fast, right?
Yeah. And I kind of...
It's all right. Can't. Yeah. And no, I appreciate that. So that's why I have you here. Slow me down. So to recap, if we're doing a case costing here for an ophthalmology procedure, and we're trying to figure out what number we should put in to our cost per case here, what we would do is, well, let's say that we're a single specialty ophthalmology practice, and we want to figure out our cost per case. We go in and look at our total paid hours for the organization, for all the clinical staff, for all the clinical staff.
What do you spend every month, every year, whatever?
You're basically going to your payroll records, right? You're going to your payroll records and getting your total paid hours.
Okay.
So you would look at all those total paid hours for the people that are involved in the ophthalmology case procedures. And then you divide that number. Let's say that it's $12,000 or 12,000 hours for the year by the cases, which, just to make it simple, is 2,000 cases. Then you're going to come up with 6 clinical hours per case.
But in order to calculate, different.
Well, what you're going to, this is an average. So you're going to take that 6 clinical hours per case and multiply it by your average salary per case or per hour. So if it's 6 clinical hours per case, you multiply it by, say, $30 per hour, and you're going to come up with $180 for that case for the labor, for the direct labor. Does that make sense?
So you're using the same number for each case.
That's correct. So it could be confusing, you know, like the example I just gave. This is an ophthalmology center, so all the cases are going to be alike. So 6 clinical hours per case across the board would make sense for all those procedures.
Okay.
Now, if this were a multi-specialty and they were doing ophthalmology and orthopedics, those numbers would be different. And it's probably not fair to be using the 6 clinical hours for the orthopedic cases, just like you're doing with the ophthalmology cases.
So you just figure them each differently.
You're going to want to figure them out separately. Mm-hmm. Either look at your staffing or use some of these national averages that are available and compare them against your numbers and see how you come against the national averages. So this was a deep dive into case costing, a very difficult thing to do on a podcast. But again, if you have any questions about it, please don't hesitate to reach out to me by email at info@ascpodcast.com, and I'll help you through it. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about events going on in the industry.
John, you've written a number of popular books about the ASC industry. Can you tell us about them?
Sure. So the two that are in publication right now, which are most popular, is the ASC Survey Guide, which is a guide to the Ambulatory Surgery Center Conditions for Coverage and Interpretive Guidelines. And it basically, it's very, very long, but it's a nicely indexed book that provides all the regulations applicable for Medicare-certified surgery centers in the United States with the interpretive guidelines nicely referenced so that you can find the interpretive guidelines that apply to the specific regulations, as well as any of the additional information that's provided by CMS for each of those regulations. And the second book is the ASC governance book, which is a great book for either a governing body members or owners of surgery centers or the administrators who like to know what the surgery center owners need to be doing. It's nice and short because it's written largely for doctors who have short attention spans. Just kidding. But anyway, it's a good book to understand what responsibility you take on when you join the governing body of an organization. So,
okay. And how does someone get these books?
So please visit reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com, regbooks.com. And you can purchase both of those books at that website. You can also get a special offer if you purchase a book through the website for a one-day consultation with me for $19.95, which includes a tour of your facility, review of your quality assurance program, governing body meetings, look at the sample of medical records, credential charts and employee charts, scan of the policy manual, you know, kind of review, quick overview of the life safety stuff. And it includes a very comprehensive debriefing afterwards, a full day on site with you. I love doing these things. It's great to get out and talk to people. Most of the time, you know, people are really grateful. Actually, all the time, people are very grateful for this service. And at $19.95, you can't get a better deal. You can also buy the books on Amazon or most online book websites.
So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry. Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
So the New Jersey State Association and the New Jersey Department of Health are partnering for an infection control event on February 26th at the Galloping Hills Country Club in Kenilworth, New Jersey. This is an all-day educational event on infection control, and the Department of Health and the State Association are partnering to talk about infection control. It includes a dozen speakers presenting a wide variety of timely and important topics related to infection control. The next Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist Exam, or the CAPE exam, is scheduled for March 1st through the 31st, 2019 at testing sites throughout the United States. Unfortunately, it's too late to sign up for it, but if you have signed up for it, please don't forget to take it. For more information about the CAPE exam, please visit aboutcape.org, which is aboutcaip.org.
And the next Certified Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrator, or CASC exam, is scheduled for May 1st through 31st, 2019 at testing sites throughout the United States. Electronic application must be submitted between March 1st and 31st, 2019. For more information, please visit aboutcasc.org.
ASCA 2019 will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through the 18th, 2019. I am so excited about going out there and and attending this conference. I've got three speeches planned, and I think the entire gang's going with us, so it'll be a fantastic time. Make sure you're there. This is the place to be if you're in the ASC industry.
And the New Jersey State Association's 9th Annual ASC Conference is May 28th and May 29th at the Hilton East Brunswick, Three Tower Center Boulevard in East Brunswick, New Jersey.
I'll be speaking at that conference also. I have to pick a topic this week, so don't forget to remind me to deal with that. The Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, also known as APICS, 46th Annual Conference is June 12th through the 14th, 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And the Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association Annual Conference is June 27th and 28th, 2019 at the Camelback Inn and Spa in Scottsdale, Arizona.
So that's it for this edition of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recording from Hilton Head Island. Join us again in a few weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting that subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.